Welcome back to Commerce Experience, everyone. I'm your host, Brian Walker, Chief Strategy Officer at Bloomreach. Today, we're going to cover one of everyone's favorite topics, taxes. The reality, of course, is that sales tax, VAT, and duties are all an important part of the commerce experience, even though none of us really want to think very much about it. But today, we're going to explore that with our guest, Evan Wright. Evan is Senior Director of Cross-Border Growth at Avalara, and he brings with him over 10 years of experience working with large organizations and SaaS businesses, and has extensive knowledge in cross-border e-commerce operations, as well, of course, as tax. In this episode, we're going to look at international e-commerce, financial compliance, and taxes. Everything your organization needs to know to be compliant with tax regulations in different countries, what you need to have in place to successfully scale at an international level, and how to properly manage international transactions to create high-quality customer experience while, of course, also protecting your business. Enjoy the show. Evan, thanks so much for joining us here today on the podcast. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian. Excited to be here.
I want to start with the first question we ask every guest on the podcast, and that is, what was your first job or role that dealt with digital or e-commerce?
My first role was right out of college working for a logistics freight forwarding company. So started getting into the e-commerce play from a logistics side of the house and realized how archaic that world was. Transition more over to the forward-thinking SaaS-based companies that could, you know, improve the experience through technology and automation.
So what time frame are we talking about with logistics?
2012 to 2014.
Well, I'm not sure that the logistics industry has made huge strides yet, but they're working on it.
Yeah. Slowly but surely, they're coming around.
Yeah. So, Evan, my first question I want to dive into with respect to kind of taxes and so forth, and it might seem a little bit dated, but I just kind of want to go back to the early days of e-commerce. And there used to be a ton of discussion and conversation around tax nexus and which businesses needed to charge online sales tax versus those that didn't, based on where they were based, based on where the consumer was. And there was, of course, a lot of noise about some large businesses online that weren't yet charging taxes. And then there was businesses like omnichannel or catalog-based businesses that felt that they had to because of tax nexus. Based on the current state of tax law and regulation, are we past that point? Is that discussion kind of over? And now it's just sort of understood that everyone needs to be collecting sales tax and kind of operating on a common playing field?
I feel like we're getting there. We definitely at Avalara benefited from the tailwinds of that big legislation change. But, you know, it really started out a massive online marketplace that I'm sure everyone uses. created their whole business model around circumnavigating taxes. And so, you know, once they had to start collecting, they really helped level out the playing field. And now it's truly, I mean, on a daily basis, we talk to so many companies that still are not compliant and have a lot of exposure. But I would say that it is a understanding that, you know, if you sell online, it's just a part of the game that you have to collect tax wherever you're selling to. I think we're getting to that point. I still think there's a lot of people out there and businesses out there that are not doing it yet, but are knowledgeable of the fact that they need to be.
Yeah, it's interesting because it really was, like I said, I'm not exactly even sure if I have the time frame in my mind when that really started to change, but it wasn't all that long ago where that legislation change occurred and fundamentally shifted the thinking around issues like tax collection and, you know, really, as I said, level the playing field. So, of course, taxes are something that we're often taught to avoid. It's kind of woven into our culture, so to speak. And no one really loves to pay taxes, I don't think. But for a lot of businesses, it's seen as something that's kind of internal and operational, not necessarily impacting the customer, despite what we were just talking about. But I'd love to know, kind of in your mind, what are the 2 to 3 to 4 different ways that tax and tax compliance issues are creating friction in a customer experience, and kind of look at it more from a how you work with your customer, the customer experience you're delivering, how to make that a positive one for the consumer, even around something like tax.
Yeah, the big change happened in 2018, and it's been now woven into the DNA of e-commerce that you should be collecting tax. So there was a lot prior to 2018, even just after that. A lot of consumers online, I feel, would shop around to see who, you know, was actually charging tax. And, you know, I was guilty of that. And if an e-commerce player wasn't charging tax, then, you know, I'm obviously going to go with them versus a competitor, right? But I think here in the US, it's definitely become the norm that you should see, and, you know, Avalara doing a large majority of those transactions online, you should see tax pretty much calculated on most things you purchase. Where it gets kind of interesting, and to answer your question, is when you start going into cross-border e-commerce and really facilitating even just basic US to Canada transactions, right? As Canadians, their expectations are that they have to not only pay the Canadian GST or HST, but they also have to pay duties, right? So that is a kind of the hot topic of trying to figure out and ensure that you're creating that experience that allows them to see what that true cost is up front during the time of purchase. So they're not getting hit with this surprise fee at the door when the UPS driver shows up and says, hey, here's my credit card terminal and here's your package. You owe me another $100.
Hey.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can tell you so many stories of abandoned packages and not merchants trying to figure out, okay, now my stuff is now stuck on in Canada or fill in the blank country, and now I have to figure out how to get it back or abandon it altogether. So I would say that was probably the biggest piece that is impacting the tax world today.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And actually, in that context, obviously businesses have a lot of different places they can invest. There's a lot of different kinds of opportunities for them to think about their business and where to focus from both a technology and kind of operational standpoint. You're working with a lot of businesses that are looking at cross-border. I'm interested in how you think about the opportunity connected to that, what you're talking to clients about when it comes to the cross-border opportunity, you know, what growth bets are being placed on cross-border trade, both across North America and so forth, but also more broadly into Europe and even Asia. What are you hearing? How should businesses be thinking about in the context of other priorities?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when you talk to US-based merchants versus merchants that are located over in the UK or in the EU, or even Australia for that matter, of the adoption of cross-border e-commerce. You know, it really depends on what report you read, but typically they say that today the cross-border e-commerce world is right around $550 billion, right? Of the total e-commerce, I think is sitting right around 4 trillion or expected to be at 4 trillion this year. So if you look at that, you know, 20% of total e-commerce sales is cross-border, and it's expected to reach 22-25% in the next year or two. So especially as, you know, I talk from a domestic U.S. vantage point because that's where we're sitting today. But from a U.S., we had this explosive growth during COVID. Everyone had record sales. They had this huge adoption of e-commerce that probably would have taken a decade if it weren't for COVID. So we're now sitting in this hangover period where they had this explosive growth, and now, you know, the economy starting to slowly recorrect and trickle back to the norm of brick and mortar. And so now merchants are looking for that next phase of growth. And if you are selling anything of a tangible good and trying to create this online brand and curate that experience, you know, the next phase of growth is really going to be cross-border. I mean, if you think about the US population versus rest of world, you know, you got to tap into these new markets in order to achieve the growth that these companies are expecting. So that's really where the world is trending in e-commerce, is with technology becoming simplistic of the Shopify's of the world, making it so easy to start selling cross-border. That's definitely going to be the next phase of growth, is really tapping into those additional markets. And, you know, it depends on what you're selling and where your brand is really identifying, but it's definitely the next phase.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting growth opportunity. And obviously for American marketers, recognizing that American culture and American trends naturally flow over borders. And that's just kind of the reality based on the reach of the culture and the media and entertainment industrial complex, if you will. And that demand is there. And there's an opportunity to capitalize on that, whether it's in a market that's very close and adjacent, like Canada or Mexico, or obviously reaching across oceans into Europe and Asia and further afield. And so there's already demand there. And many can see the traffic in their metrics and understand how much traffic they're getting from outside the country. And if they could improve upon the conversion rate and start to capitalize on that without necessarily having to invest in operational or fulfillment capability in those countries in the near term, that's a really interesting opportunity to explore. And so that question, you touched on it a little bit already, but talk a little bit about sort of the customer experience component of being a customer ordering from outside, let's just say the United States for purposes of this question. And, you know, what can go wrong and how to fix that if you're a merchant trying to sell cross-border?
There is a lot of complexity that comes with selling cross-border, right? The opportunity is massive. We already identified that. But there is pitfalls in terms of what can go right and what can go wrong, or really wrong, right? So the typical workflow that we see with merchants that are trying to just tip their toe in the water of cross-border e-commerce, you know, I think they would start selling in English speaking countries so that they don't have to do this full language translation on their website. But it's an evolution, right? So I like to think of the cross-border e-commerce world as there's really four pillars to it in order to a successful experience. You know, there's a localization experience where you have to translate into local language, local shopping experience. Do they include taxes in product price, or do they display them at the checkout experience? There is a payment pillar, right? So do they accept what forms of payment? Not everyone accepts Visa and MasterCard around the world. They have Alipay or in China, or fill in the blank payment option in certain countries. Then there's the logistics, like how do I actually get my products to these buyers, right? Do I have good carrier network that can facilitate the transit time that you know they would expect? So to go back and touch on your point of the true nature of these experiences today, is most companies are saying, hey, look, there's a ton of traffic coming to my website from, you know, Australia. I'm just going to go ahead and just, some of them have converted and, you know, we'll start accepting orders from Australia. They'll ship it. They won't display any sort of local taxes or duties or any of that in checkout, which is what we call a, you know, a delivered at place experience, which, you know, we give to DHL or FedEx or UPS or fill in the blank carrier. And 2 weeks later, that package arrives in Australia and they go up to the customer's door and or they'll get a nice little notice in their inbox saying, hey, you owe us an extra $200 or $150 in duties and taxes in order to collect your package. I don't know about you, but me as a consumer, I'd be furious. I'd be like, I was not expecting this. I didn't want this. I would have bought it locally. So I have the option to actually reject that package. So that experience, you know, even if I was to pay the $150 in duties and taxes, I'm probably never going to buy from that merchant again, right? So that just tarnished your brand experience and that brand persona, which marketers are really trying to curate and hold dear, right? To, you know, increase their persona in that market. So what we're seeing is a lot of companies shift over to what we call delivered duties paid. So they're going and doing the upfront work to ensure that they can display what we call a true landed cost in checkout. So you as a consumer can say, hey, I'm going to purchase this product it may be a little bit more expensive, or but you know, the brand and you know, desirable and back to the
unique product, what have
exactly,
you.
Yeah. Right. So they're collecting all of that money up front in checkout. So then, you know, I like to call it the Amazon experience, right? The box just shows up on your doorstep and you don't owe anything else. But that's really where the whole e-commerce market is shifting to, is to curate and own this experience. Because really, at the end of the day, as an e-commerce company, you have this online persona, and then you have that physical delivery that is truly associated to your brand. So you want to own as much of that customer experience as possible.
Personal story. The last time I experienced that was ordering a case of Amaro and vermouth from Italy. And it showed up and it was misclassified, which meant that it was classified as spirits, which was a much higher duty rate than like fortified wine and that sort of thing. So I actually had to like go through the hassle of getting the product reclassified so that I could pay a lower duty through the carrier, which was, of course, a hassle. You know, I really wanted the Amaro, so I wasn't going to turn it down. But the so that gets into kind of a geeky topic in some ways, something that I think many of our listeners may have some awareness of, depending on, you know, their background in product sourcing or design and importing and so forth. But I know you have a fair bit of background in, and that's the harmonized tariff code system and how that plays a role in all of this when it comes to cross-border trade. And I'd love to sort of touch on that. So let's first start with kind of what is an HTS code and why should people care?
Yeah, well, I think you even got to back up a little bit further, right? So what is this system that we're talking about? So this system is really how countries monitor import and export volume and products and really manage what we call tariffs, right? So if there's trade wars and tariffs are changing, I'm sure everyone's heard about these, but they're all driven from this harmonization system. And what it is it's a numeric system that identifies products and its materials associated to that product. So a good example is this beautiful orange sweatshirt that I'm wearing, right? I don't care that it's
I would call it peach, but that's okay.
Okay. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, right? What color it is. It matters about what materials. What the customs agents care about is this a synthetic man-made material? Is it a cotton? And that is really what is going to drive the tariff rate that is imposed on me importing this product into the U.S. from China or India or Indonesia, right? It doesn't matter. But they look at what is the materials that are associated to this particular product. And it's a book that is probably about 2.5 feet thick that you have to navigate through to figure out, all right, how do I classify this product? And what's unique about it is 200 countries have come together and said, we all agree on this system to manage international trade. And this system has each of these codes are universal in some context up to a certain level. And then each country comes in on top of that and says, hey, we're going to impose our own unique categorization of these products. So they tag on what they call the national level digits onto the end. So 6 digits of this code are universal, and then each country has a unique flavor on the end, and it gets incredibly complex. I was studying to become a customs broker until I realized, you know, how archaic this system is, how hard it really is. More of an art than a science in terms of this classification process. So you talk to any licensed customs broker and they'll go on and on about how great this and interesting the system is, but it is a complex world for, you know, a basic e-commerce merchant to be able to navigate it.
And it goes all the way back to the product sourcing. So you as a merchant, right, your company is already, in a sense, like a part of the system in a way, right? The products you may be importing to sell and so forth have already been classified. But often that's kind of long gone and kind of lost in a system somewhere focused on product sourcing or buying, potentially. And then when it comes to in the cross-border scenario we were talking about earlier, the freight forwarder that you're using to ship the product to the customer is often classifying it for delivery to the end consumer, And that can go wrong as well, which can lead to like very high duties and tariffs for the end consumer that may not actually be what it could be if the product had been classified differently. And I'm not saying you want to skirt the definitions necessarily, but as you said, there's an art to it. There's a nuance in the code there that can be applied, especially when you're talking about exporting it. And so how can businesses be thinking about that in a smart way as they start to implement cross-border and scale this up?
I think you hit on a really important piece, right? Because most e-commerce merchants that I speak with, right, they're worried about selling their products. They don't, but, and what they don't have a lot of knowledge about is the actual international trade component behind it. So how important these harmonization codes are to their business, it really needs to be stressed and emphasized. These codes, if you leave it to your carrier to classify, or you leave it to your forwarder to classify, or you just take the code that your importer gave you, when you sell that to another country, they're going to have to, the carrier, they don't want to spend a lot of time classifying your codes. So what they're going to do is they're just going to take that highest tariff rate that correlates to that category of items and associate to it.
Because it's the safest thing.
It's the safest thing. So they are not going to lose money on that shipment, right? They're saying, hey, we'll take the safest route because we don't want to get fined from customs. So we'll take the safest route. We'll take this 20% tariff when realistically you should have been paying a 5 or 6 or 7% rate. So all of a sudden you just made that product that much more expensive to your customer or potentially to you as the merchant with now this paradigm shift of collecting all those duties up front in the checkout experience, right? So it's really, really important for businesses to focus and have a process in place to classify their products up front upon before they even list it on their website. And, you know, that again, it gets complex as you start looking at, I want to sell to the UK versus the EU versus Japan versus Australia, because each of those are a unique code.
Yeah, fascinating. And it has that direct impact on the end customer and can either benefit or limit your opportunity to capitalize on cross-border, which I think is really interesting. So what are some ways, you know, a business person could look to solve for this kind of complexity around the infrastructure to support cross-border? You know, what are some different ways that business people can look at that question and try to approach it without driving a lot of complexity into their operation?
Yeah, well, it starts with strategic sourcing too, right? So where are you sourcing your products from? Is it coming from China? But there, again, back to this adoption of technology, there are now tools out there that can allow us to, you know, use machine learning or artificial intelligence to help predict and classify products either on a batch format or on a one-off basis, or tools to help, you know, your internal merchandising teams look up codes and associate rates. There's a lot of different tools out there, but the historic way of doing this is, you know, reach out to your customs broker. They're going to charge you an hourly rate to classify it, which can be expensive. You can go to your big four firm, which also gets incredibly expensive because they're charging an hourly rate. Or you can have a carrier do it who is not going to spend a lot of time and, you know, as we talked about, take that highest rate. So I would say in the last couple of years, there's been a really large adoption of classification technology. Avalara has some. There is other players out there that also do this well. But because of the sophistication and back to that art versus science, right, of classification, it's really hard for technology to do it 100% by itself. Because if you think of Air Jordan, Nike, basketball shoe, right? Sometimes technology, depending on the way the words are described, may classify your shoe as a basketball. Whereas, so you do need this human component to review and create this machine learning model. So it's reviewing and then feeding back into the model the next time, which is how Avalara has designed it. But there's lots of great tools up there, but it's really just back to that business user saying, hey, I need to focus on this because, again, back to my tenets, growth is one of my biggest ones because of this massive opportunity. And how do I ensure I set myself up to actually capitalize on this is classify my products correctly so that, you know, I'm ensuring that I know what that tariff rate is at the time of checkout so I can maximize my profit on these transactions. Because, you know, there's two really philosophies in cross-border e-commerce. You know, the historic way was, hey, I can just outsource this because it's 5% of my business and I'll give it to what we've coined as black box providers. Think about
where they're essentially merchants of record, right? They're exactly. Essentially the retailer and they're going to take a cut and essentially handle payments and fulfillment and so forth for you. So in a sense, it simplifies the problem for you, but it may actually cut into your profits and your margins pretty significantly. And you, in a sense, can lose control of the customer experience in the process.
I think the last point is the biggest one, right? These players, you know, yeah, it's easy, right? And if you're not worried about the 2% of your business, but I think we've just talked about and emphasized the massive opportunity, right? But they have essentially taken your customer experience away from you. And as an e-commerce brand, you know, that customer experience is everything. That brand persona is everything. So outsourcing it to these third parties as a merchant of record may be easy and less of a headache, but they take a significant cut of your margin. I've heard somewhere between 10 and 15, sometimes 20% of your margin is going to these. So that's top line revenue that could be associated in. I think, again, technology is improving to a point where most brands can do cross-border e-commerce plugins to their e-commerce platform. You know, Shopify rolled out a way to just turn on language translation, turn on duties and taxes, turn on cross-border shipping. And most of these players are doing something similar. Shop, Salesforce, Magento, all of these big names, right, have easy add-ons so that you don't need to completely outsource that to a merchant of record solution.
Yeah, and various point solution providers come in as well to complement this and both give you the tools from a technology and kind of an operational standpoint to scale this up. And, you know, I think there's good justification if you're a business that wants to take advantage of this, but needs to keep it simple to do so. But that's probably not your long-term solution. And you really need to be thinking ahead and preparing your organization for investment required to do it the right way at some point in time.
Yeah, what we've seen is, you know, especially for high priority lanes, right? So, you know, maybe it makes sense to do a merchant record solution for all of Latin America or Africa or Eastern Europe. But, you know, hey, I have a lot of my revenue and a lot of my orders are coming from the UK, Australia, France, and I should own that brand and customer experience and not give away so much margin. So we've seen kind of a flavor of both too, where they have pointed solutions for their high priority lanes and then more of a merchant record model for their lower emerging markets.
Yeah, absolutely. So switching back to maybe sort of core tax and tax compliance, you know, another kind of nuance that certainly happens quite a bit is different jurisdictions, different countries have varying levels of complexity down to like local jurisdictions. Sometimes those local jurisdictions not only are charging different tax rates, but might apply to different categories differently. They do things like tax holidays and all these different kind of things that the consumers in those markets may be very well aware of, but you as a retailer or a brand selling online may not easily track. And this is, of course, where sort of software comes in. Can you help characterize, like, what is that complexity? Which markets it kind of rears its head more so in, so that people kind of get a sense for that if they're not familiar with that?
Yeah, I think the biggest market for that is in the US. We have the most screwed up tax system in the world. I mean, it is god awful. But with that, because each state can characterize and classify and create their own, you know, unique rules, as you said, tax holidays. You know, I always like to use New York as a good one. You know, if you go to New York and you buy a whole bagel that's not cut and spread cream cheese on, a whole bagel is not taxable. But as soon as I cut that bagel and put cream cheese, it is now taxable. You know, what I sell is software as a service. Texas says my good is 80% taxable. And they said it's 80% of good and 20% of service. Therefore, I not only have to figure out what the local rate is, but I have to tax it at 80% of that rate. So it's just incredibly complex. There's 13,000 different taxing jurisdictions in the US alone, where most of the world, you know, there's one tax rate for the entire country. You know, over in the EU, it's a standard VAT rate, a value added tax.
So it's just
value added tax, 20%. And then they have certain categories of items that may get a reduced rate. You know, maybe it's baby goods or pharmaceuticals or some of those things that get reduced rates. Canada has 12 rates. The other really complex one is Brazil and now India, I think are the other two. But US definitely leads the charge on complexity.
So you need to have solutions in place, basically, to support that, especially when you think about your finance and revenue operations part of the organization. Like, they're essentially the ones who are going to need a solution for sure, but they may not necessarily be thinking about the front end customer experience, which is why as an e-commerce leader, I'd say understanding this and making sure you kind of got both parts of it covered is really important.
Yeah, and I think as, you know, a business leader, it's ensuring you're not setting your executives up for failure, right? Because as an executive of a company, you are technically liable for uncollected taxes too. So with this whole decision of it's Wayfair versus South Dakota back in 2018, you are now liable to collect tax in those 13,000 different taxing jurisdictions if you have triggered what they call even economic nexus now, meaning I sell 100 transactions or even $100,000 in revenue into a state. It's typically the threshold. Each state's a little different, but typically it's $100,000 or 100 individual transactions into a state triggers your obligation to now collect tax, which is, and as you're starting to see, different governments are now adopting something similar. So with Brexit happening, they got rid of this low value e-commerce threshold too. So they said everything coming into the UK should be collecting tax on. There is what they call the deemed supplier laws in the EU, which they're going after marketplaces saying that, hey, we want the marketplace to be liable for collecting tax, and it's trickling down to the individual businesses as well. So it's starting to become the norm all around the world, is because they're seeing the volume of these e-commerce packages saying, we're not collecting any tariffs on it. We're not getting any tax revenue on it. It's just sliding under the radar, and they're quickly plugging those holes.
Yeah, governments seem pretty motivated to capture revenue where they can, especially these days.
Death and taxes, you know, the two.
Well, Evan, it's been really terrific to have you on. I want to turn to the last question we ask every guest who's on the podcast. And that can deal with tax or cross-border if you want, or the field's wide open. Okay. That question is, what futuristic digital commerce innovation are you most looking forward to? Or alternatively, what do you think is overhyped and you wish people would just stop talking about because you think it'll just be an unmitigated failure? So you can go high, you can go low.
Oh, that's a good question. I would say the one that I am most hyped on is simplifying this e-commerce experience, right? So as these platforms start making it just so chimp simple to sell to anyone, anywhere, anything, similar to the kind of the marketplace model, but as your own individual brand and creating your own brand identity online, I think is just, we're only at the beginning phases of this. So it's just selling anywhere, anything to anyone. It's really making the world flat. And that's what gets me excited and gets me going and really just taking all of the complexity out of the equation, right? And so that's where we're marching towards. And I think we're going to get there.
Yeah, I think from a technology perspective, we're definitely within reach. And you see platforms out there who are already, as you pointed out earlier, really starting to take the friction out, especially for small businesses to be able to support, you know, what a larger business would have been able to support in the past. Now it's sort of democratizing that, so to speak. I think it will be interesting to see how governments respond, though, because there's always going to be pressure to protect local markets, protect, you know, local business people. We see that in markets, for example, like India, which has actually kind of regulated restrictions on goods coming into India from cross-border trade, right? So it'll be interesting to see how governments respond to that. And are we going to enter into a new phase, in a sense, as you sort of pointed out? Like, we can get there technically relatively soon, I think. But I think the bigger challenge is going to be, how do different markets respond?
Yeah, I think your point is fascinating. And it's, you're starting to see it already. With, there's a new adoption, and 60 countries have adopted this already, called e-invoicing, right? So it's real-time transactions hitting government databases to say, hey, I need to get a transaction ID on everything that I'm selling, no matter what it is. I have to ping the government to get this transaction ID and register in their system before I can even send it to my customer. So you're already starting to see it, but you know, I'd say typically government is about 5 years behind commerce, right? So it's just
that might be generous, but yeah, absolutely. So it will be interesting, and I think politically, culturally, it'll be interesting to see: are we really in a next phase in the sense of global trade, or are we going to see more protectionism settle in different places in the world? How is that going to play out? We'll have to see. Obviously, that's something to watch for sure.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to look in the next 5 years just to see kind of where we land in that. But there's definitely a couple different approaches that governments are taking, right? That protectionism versus let trade actually flow.
Yeah, and of course, there's large economies of the world where essentially the economy itself is large enough to support free and frictionless trade within, you know, a large region. United States is actually one of those. European Union is another. You could even argue China and India are large enough economies that they, in a sense, are unto themselves as well. But when it comes to cross-border, obviously, we're talking well beyond that. And that's where the opportunity lies to remove friction. And there's a lot of benefit that can come from that. But not everyone necessarily sees it the same way. So we'll see.
Well, the opportunity is there. So I think it's every business that I talk to on a daily basis is thinking about that next phase of how do I capitalize and keep that growth momentum coming around COVID, right?
Wonderful. Well, Evan, I've loved the conversation. Thanks again for taking the time to be here with us today. And to all of our listeners out there, check out the show notes for opportunities to connect with Evan and myself. And thank you so much for listening. Meanwhile, be safe, be well. And here's to good business.